Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Veterans Advocate. My guest today is John West. He was on Johnson Island, just like Ron and Frank. John was an officer, and he has a lot of interesting experiences and a lot of compelling stories he's going to share with us today. It's on a similar theme of Johnson Island and some of the health issues that have resulted from that. He's got a lot of information to share with us today, so I'd like to introduce John. John, how are you, sir?
I'm fine.
Thank you so much for reaching out to me. I think you saw one of my posts in the Johnson Island Facebook group, and perhaps you've seen the video with either Frank or Ron or listened to the podcast. But anyway, you reached out to me and shared some of your experiences and have agreed to let me interview you. So I want to thank you for that up front.
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
So if you wouldn't mind, I'd kind of just like to hear your story from beginning to end. So you were in the Air Force, correct?
Correct. I was in Air Force Systems Command in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and then operational commands after that. While I was in Systems Command, I worked out of Los Angeles Air Force Station, and one of my jobs was the program manager and senior engineer for a system called the Thor missile. Johnston Island, I had two of them out there on a classified program that we phased out in 72, and in 73, rather than remove them, we became part of an Army program to launch the missiles from Johnston Island into Kwajalein. So that's kind of my experience with Johnston. I had about, I'd say, 200 days on island TDY from 73 through 75. Was supported by a Air Defense Command unit, the 10th Missile Warning Squadron. They were actually my launchers, and they were very professional. So when we were out there, we kind of considered it an island paradise, even if it was in the middle of nowhere. Later on, we found out there was some dark sides to it. There's kind of three eras of contamination. One was in the 60s, when there was some nuclear testing out there. Three tests actually deposited plutonium on the island. We'll get into that later. Then in 72, the Air Force moved Agent Orange on the island and stored it right next to our launch site. That's what we'll talk about a little bit today. As you're familiar with Agent Orange, we used it in Vietnam from 62 through 71. In 71, a lot of health issues came to light, and they decided not to use it. They had made about 20 million gallons of it, and in 71, they had about 2.1 million gallons left over. Some of it was in the States, but most of it was in Vietnam. So rather than bring it back to the States, Congress decided put it someplace else until we figure out what to do with it. So a program called PACER brought 25,219 barrels of it, about 1.3 million gallons, to Johnston Island and stacked it up near the end of the runway and left it. They said they'd be back when they figure out what to do with it. Well, it took them about 5 years to figure out what they wanted to do. In the intermediate time, government reports said there was about 49,000 pounds of it being leaked into the Johnson Island land and sea environment. The barrels arrived in very poor condition. We had about 25 leakers a week spread over the 5 years. And they finally figured out what to do with it. But Agent Orange, if you're familiar with it, was actually a combination of two herbicides, one called 2,4-D, and one was called 2,4,5-T. Unfortunately, the latter had an unintended contaminant called dioxin. The shorthand is TCDD. It's a long, complicated name that I don't think anybody really needs to know. But anyway, they figured out the only way to get rid of dioxin was to literally burn it at above 1,000 degrees centigrade. So they hired a ship from Holland. They brought it over. It stopped in the United States in Gulfport, Louisiana, I believe. Picked up all this was still left in the United States, about 800,000 gallons of it, brought it out to Johnston Island, then burned it at sea, then came back and burned the rest of it, took two more burns at sea. So at the end of August of 1977, it was gone from the island. Well, during the 5 years it was there, it leaked a lot. You could smell it, you could see it. If you dove in the lagoon, you could see a sheen on the water. So obviously it was leaking. And if you're familiar with tropical islands, it rains every day, except for 2 months out of the year in the doldrums. So, you know, we also had tropical storms and whatever. So there was some concern. So the Air Force Environmental and Occupational Lab at Brooks Air Force Base came out in August of 1979. That's 700 days after the last barrel left. And they did some soil and water samples because they had to clean it up. And one of the water, basically they took a lot of soil samples from the site, but they also took five water samples, three of which in the lagoon and two on land. And the place that they were concerned about was Johnston Island is a desert island. We have no or had no source of fresh water. It wasn't big enough to catch the rain. So we had a desalinization plant. So basically we plumbed into the lagoon and desalinated the water. So they tested for dioxin, which was pretty rare in those days. Not just Agent Orange, but the dioxin. It's pretty hard to find. So they tested for it at the intake to the plant, at the output of the plant, another location about 3 or 4 miles away from Johnston, just another island, but in the lagoon, and then in the mess hall. And they sent the data or the samples off to the University of Utah. And the results came back that it tested positive, all five of them tested positive to dioxin in parts per trillion. All right, I don't know if that surprised anybody or not, but it's the only test I know of at that time that was actually looking for dioxin at the levels of parts per trillion. So what does that really mean? Well, today the EPA has what's called a maximum contaminant level measure. It's associated with the Safe Water Act. Okay. We're all familiar with Flint, Michigan and the lead in it. Okay. The MCL for lead is 15 parts per billion. All right. The MCL for the two components of Agent Orange is 50 and 70 parts per billion. All right. Dioxin is a whole nother world. The MCL for dioxin is 30 parts per quadrillion. Okay, if you know your math, a trillion or a quadrillion is 1,000 times larger than a trillion. But if you're dealing with parts per billion or trillion, or excuse me, trillion or quadrillion, what we had was Brooks came up with measurements of around 20 parts per trillion. The MCL for dioxin, the EPA today, is 30 parts per quadrillion. If you do the math, that's hundreds of times above the safe level. So what did that really say? If we were doing it today, the water system on Johnston Island in 1979 was highly contaminated with dioxin. All right. And that's 700 days after the last barrel left. So if you talk to a scientist and ask him the question, how high was the levels of dioxin while it was still leaking, he'd say, well, it's scientifically certain it's way higher than what you measured, but since nobody measured, nobody knows. So basically what happened when we were there, we had dioxin in our morning shower, our morning coffee, our iced tea at lunch, in the swimming pool, that sort of stuff. Didn't know it. Nobody did. And to be fair to the whole system, dioxin wasn't very well understood during that period in time. So, but what did it prove? It proved that dioxin was present at least at three locations in the lagoon and in the water plant and in our whole water system, because one of the places they tested was the mess hall. So, did anybody else test for dioxin? Well, the University of Boston Department of Biology in 2008 presented a paper at one of their symposiums on coral reefs that basically said they had looked at a series of biological tests of the fish in the lagoon. They looked at 80 species. 35% of them had dioxin in their internals, mainly in the kidneys. So what that proved was what leaked into the dioxin that leaked into the lagoon contaminated the fish and contaminated the water supply. So let's get on to the VA. I work a lot with wounded warriors. At a certain level, I really see a lot of really good work being done in the VA. So this is not a complaint about the VA itself, at least at the working level. However, for reasons we've never really figured out, the VA has never acknowledged that there was any exposure to the people on the island because the Agent Orange was there. Their position is, and this is based on studies done by other people, I won't bring them up, but they've since been contested is about the best way to say it. Their first position is that the Agent Orange was contained in the storage area because they put a fence around it. All right. The second one was the only people on the island that had any potential of being exposed were the people that actually handled it. You can imagine 27 leakers a week. That was a lot of people that had to move the drums, basically repair them or re-drum the stuff. So if you look at the first point they make, and I've just recently received another letter from the VA trying to reinforce this, they basically say that it was contained in the area and contamination was not widespread. If you look at the Brooks data and the Boston University data, it's totally false, because the dioxin is in the lagoon. It's probably still there today. Okay, so what has happened recently? Well, first of all, the bottom line on just about everybody I know, and there's probably been hundreds of people that have gone to the VA to try to get some sort of Agent Orange connection. Universally, they've all been turned down. Now, I've found one security policeman, oddly enough, that got a really good lawyer, and he was given some sort of exposure criteria. But the basic person that, you know, worked in the units that I worked with, they've all tried and they've all been turned down. So what's happened recently? Well, you've probably heard of something called the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019. All right. It's basically saying that if you were on a Navy ship whose source of potable water was desalinization, and from 65 to 75 or thereabouts, you were within 12 miles of Vietnam or Cambodia, you were assumed to have been exposed. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, you had to prove, A, that you were on the ship, that the ship was there, and by some means prove it was in that area. People have gone back in, and there's actually a database of the ships. We found one, USS Brandon. It was a small destroyer. It was in Saigon River for 2 days in May of 66, I think. All the crew on board, 300 people on board, because of this act, which is a good thing, it's public law 116-23, they are now assumed to have been exposed. Now, to file a claim, they have to prove a lot of things, one of which is they have one of the 13 or 14 diseases associated, the VA says are associated with Agent Orange. But one of the reasons that the bill was passed was there had always been some concern among the Navy that, hey, we desalinate the water and all this Agent Orange was coming down the river. Nobody thought much about it until the Australian VA looked at data from their naval personnel, because they had ships there, believe it or not, and compared it to their ground personnel that were there. They found the cancer limit or the cancer numbers were about double. So they did a study and they basically recreated a desalinization plant. They ran dioxin through it. They came up to two conclusions. One, desalinization does not move or remove dioxin at all. So if you got contaminated seawater going in, you got fresh water coming out with dioxin. The other thing was it concentrated it. It basically enhanced it. That last conclusion has been called into question. But the basic thing was this study basically tipped Congress into saying, well, nobody made measurements. Nobody got sick, you know, until years later. But based on caution, we're going to pass this bill. And it's good how there's estimates of between 40,000 and 100,000 sailors that as of 1 January are now eligible to file a complaint if they have a disease that they think's associated with it. Okay, let's compare somebody on Johnston Island. All right. I had a very good senior master sergeant working for me. Prior to the mission that I had another mission out there that was anti-satellite. So he spent 14 90-day TDYs from about 71 through 76 on the island. Okay, that's over 1,000 days. Okay. The VA would not accept that he'd been exposed. Even though, you know, now that we've found both the Brooks data and the Boston University data. So, and the crazy thing is, if you look at Johnston Island, the only thing it isn't is a ship, because it gets its water from desalinization. It gets its Agent Orange 2 miles away, full strength, leaking into the lagoon. Okay. The Brooks data proved that it was in the water system. The Boston University basically says it was obviously in the lagoon also. So it's identical to the criteria of the blue water sailors. But to date, no one has recognized that. All right, so where are we? Well, good news is the Blue Water Sailors Act has been out there. And as of 1 January, a lot of people are, you know, able to get some assumed exposure. There is one other bill that hasn't been approved yet. It's H.R. 1713. It's called the Lonnie Kirkpatrick Central Pacific Herbicide Relief Act. What started this? Well, Agent Orange wasn't just used in Vietnam. It was used to control brush and whatever in various locations. What a lot of people are saying was it was used on Guam, it was used in Korea, it was used in other areas. Okay, well, we were able to get Johnston Island included in it. So if this act passes, Johnston Island will join the, you know, the list of assumed exposure. Right now there's 88 co-sponsors, and this is in the House. What I'd recommend to anybody that's listening that matches any of this stuff from Guam or whatever, get involved with your congressman, get involved with your senator, and try to get this bill passed. Johnston Island, you know, obviously we need all the criteria of the Navy Act, and we'd also meet this. So perhaps after 40 years, a lot of the claims that have been made over the years will be reopened, I guess. You know, the only downside is there's probably 40,000 people now in front of us again. So we're really not sure what the VA does. But that's kind of the Johnston Island Agent Orange story as I know it. You know, I've spent a lot of time since a lot of the people that I work with are no longer with us. You know, whether it was, you know, just normal age or Agent Orange or, you know, the plutonium that we'll talk about in another session. Johnston Island was a great place to be, but the dark side of it is kind of getting to us. So that's the herbicide orange.
So if I understand right, this H.R. 1713, that looks to include Johnston Island. So if that passes the House and the Senate and gets signed by the President, it would potentially open up veterans from Johnson Island to be able to claim benefits from the VA?
Well, what happens? It's like the Blue Water Navy. It's making the assumption that if you were at this location or on this ship, you are assumed to be exposed to Agent Orange. You know, in Johnston Island capability, it was, you know, through the desalinization. And if you're assumed, then when you file a claim with the VA, they have to assume, the assumption is that the exposure is service related. Okay. Based on that assumption, and you look at, you know, the, I think it's up to 13 now, diseases, cancers, diabetes, there's a whole list of things on the VA list that if you have that, no matter when it is, it's assumed that you got it from Agent Orange. And then they will give you benefits based on that.
Yeah, that would be huge, because my understanding is it's an automatic service-connected denial for anything related to Johnson Island, which is unfortunate.
I've only found one that's been approved. Now, you know, I haven't looked. I've been looking for 10 years. You know, just because, well, basically some of the people in the unit asked me, said, hey, you're an engineer, go fix this. So I've been trying, you know, same thing with the radiation. But anyway, you know, hopefully if we can get, I don't know, half the senators and House to do it, they'll do it. Oddly enough, there are 69 Democrats right now and only 19 Republicans. Just a factoid.
Yeah.
And well,
hopefully the
bill has, basically it's in the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, but it's just sitting there because it doesn't have enough sponsors.
Okay.
I guess.
Well, that gives us an actionable item, though, to attack. I didn't realize that that resolution existed. So now that we know what it is and we know that it exists.
Get the word out.
Yeah, we can try to get our word out on that. Yeah. I think it's one of those things that if enough people make the phone call, that enough people take action, that something will happen. Because I'm sure that's how it happened with the Blue Water Navy. The government doesn't just preemptively elect to give people the ability for benefits just because they might need them. That's the exact opposite of what the government does. The government waits until the very last possible minute to pass any kind of resolution like this.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not really sure the numbers we're talking about. I'd say several thousand, because you're talking, you know, 72 through 75 or 77, depending on how you cut it. Because the, at least when we were out there, the ratio of military to civilian was about 50-50.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. I need to kind of wrap my head around how I'm going to attack that and get that message out there. And, obviously I can call my people individually and I can do what I can to kind of spread the message, but I'm just trying to think of the best way to do it. Do people on all the Johnson Island groups know about this resolution? Has that been made public?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Okay.
You know, from time to time, I've posted stuff on it, but I have not mentioned this. I'm pretty sure they have, but it's, you know, it's hard to say because there's about three different groups on Johnston Island, right, or on the web for Johnston Island. Oddly enough, one of the big pushers of the 1713 are SAC veterans, because during Vietnam we had a whole bunch of SAC bombers on Guam, and it's hard to say. But anyway, yeah, anything you can do to kind of pass the word on this, you know, I hope everything I said was relatively factual. It's based on about 5 years of gathering data.
No, I'm sure it is. I would love if you have the University of Utah and if you have the University of Boston data, I would love to see copies of that if you could email that to me or give me links or whatever you have.
Yeah, I can do that. the University of Utah is a letter, basically, back to Brooks with the data on it. Okay. Supposedly, they also wrote a report, but I've been unable to get it through the Freedom of Information Act yet. But, you know, that's where that came from. Now, the paper, I can send you the link to the paper itself. There's no problem with that. So, yes, make sure I've got your email and we'll go from, well, I should have it because you just sent me something.
Yeah, no, I'd really appreciate that. Then I can kind of take that information too and package it together in a way that hopefully can, you know, reach a lot of people. So we've talked about the Agent Orange, and you also mentioned that you have some interesting data on the plutonium, which is an entirely separate issue. But for those who don't know, that there have been, I think, three nuclear disasters on Johnson Island, both directly and then above in the air with things raining down debris-wise. And plutonium has a half-life of roughly 24,000 years. So once the weaponized plutonium gets atomized, it just sticks around for pretty much forever. Blows around in the sand, blows around in the air. And in this environment, many of you guys served on Johnson Island during and after these explosions, correct?
Yes. Johnson Island, because of its location, is ideal to do nuclear testing. In 1958, they launched two missiles out of there. And then in 1962, when the Soviets started testing again, they started something called Operation Dominic. And they did a series of airdrops from B-52s and Thor missiles. That's how our missiles got out there. Like you said, there were three mishaps, broken arrows, whatever you want to call them, that happened on Johnston. There were two atmospheric. This was in 1962, spring and summer of 1962. The most of concern was in July of 1962, something called Bluegill Prime. Each detonation had a name, and it was Bluegill Prime. There was a 1.5 megaton warhead on top of the Thor. They pressed launch, and we had a problem. Fuel valve stuck. And basically what happened is it started burning on the pad. Well, you're on a very small island. You've got your booster burning up with a nuke on board. What do you do? Well, the thinking at the time, and it's probably still accurate, although I don't know if they do it or not, is a nuclear weapon usually has explosives packed around the center of it. You fire the explosives, they compress it, and you get a bang. Well, at that era, the solution was what we call a single point. They fired one of the sections of explosives, which basically fragmented the warhead. Good news is the island didn't disappear in a flash. Bad news was a large amount of plutonium was ionized and thrown around the island. The winds blew off a lot of it into the lagoon, but the launch site itself was highly contaminated. All right, so the solution was to send GIs out there, and they weren't hazmat suits. They were much more primitive. Pick up the pieces, put it in a barrel, and dump it at sea. Then they scraped all the soil down for 2 or 3 inches, dumped it in the sea, and then they cleaned up the launch site and painted it over and put concrete on some of the highly contaminated areas. That was July of 62. Well, since we had the missiles out on Johnston Island and we were concerned about Soviet killer satellites, someone came up with the idea, well, why don't we use these missiles in an anti-satellite capability? Highly classified. I think very few people even know about it. But it was out there. So from about 1964 through 72, we had two missiles on alert out there 24/7. All right. Over the years, they did some surveys, and what they started finding is what they call hotspots. Plutonium is rather difficult to detect unless you've got some very sophisticated gear. But like any nuclear element, it degrades and it creates other nuclear chemicals, one of which is called americonium. It's 241 on the scale. That's a lot easier to find. So what would happen over time is they wouldn't be detecting plutonium except for very sophisticated, but they would find hot spots of americonium. So when they found them, they'd try to dig up the particle and put it in a barrel and send it to somewhere, probably Nevada someplace. But technology changed, and about 1980, they suddenly said, okay, let's really survey the island. All right, so they did. And sure enough, the hot spots were still there. But they were able to basically codify them because they knew they were going to be shutting the island down at some point in time. So they knew they were going to have to clean it up. So they came up with a number of 13.5, and it's got a, well, it's picocuries per gram. None of, you know, unless you're a scientist, it doesn't mean anything to you. So they started doing the survey, and what they found was about 500 hotspots, some of which were over seven times the safe limit of 13.5. What does that mean? Well, from 64 through at least 72, and then when we were on the island from 73 to 75, that pad was hot. Now, fine, they painted over it, they, you know, they did whatever, but it's really difficult to say what's the long-term effect on the people that were out there. You know, we're all getting old, you know, we're in of many things, but my boss was, he visited me out there just before we launched the first one. He was only on island 7 days. 3 years later, he died of stomach cancer that was incredibly invasive, and nobody knew why. Now, was it just, you know, normal environment, or was it the plutonium? We don't know, type stuff. So what did they do after we shut the pad down? Well, they knew in the future they were going to have to turn the island back to somebody. So literally, they scraped the whole area, ran it through a processor, which sorted out the high-level radioactivity from the lower activity. The high level, they took off island. The low, they basically buried under a big pile of coral. Oddly enough, it's right where my office used to be. So it's still there. There's a fence around it, and, you know, by standards, it's at the safe level. But, you know, the concern is that some very good people were operating that pad 24/7 for 8 to 10 years, knowingly, or to them, it was unknown, that it, based on the 1980 survey, was pretty hot. So anyway, that's all I know. It's really difficult to get any information on it. And it's also very difficult to find much connection between plutonium exposure and you know, any diseases. Obviously, with cancer is a big one, and that sort of stuff. But there's just not that much data. So Johnston Island was a great place to be. I had a great deal of fun out there. We, you know, we did some really good work out there, but we're now finding out that they didn't tell us everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I know about the plutonium.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. And part of it is, I think at that day and age, people did not have the same level of knowledge that they have now. But also, now that we do have the knowledge, they're also not coming clean with that knowledge, which is unfortunate.
So. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I mean, my main concern right now is just try to get the VA to acknowledge the Agent Orange exposure. So, you know, some of the people, hopefully they will go through their files and find everybody's Johnston Island denial for the last 30 or 40 years and put it ahead of the queue. I don't know if they do that or not, but otherwise, if they have to start all over again with 40 to 100,000 sailors in front of you, not many of them will make it.
Yeah. Do you think that the VA knows that? And do you think that the VA is dragging their feet to get towards that inevitable end?
It's hard to say. You know, I mean, I started about 18 months ago after I got prostate cancer, which is another one of the VA assumed things. And, you know, it was eventually denied because I couldn't prove I was exposed. Okay. And the reasons given were, you know, the ones we talked about, but basically, hey, it was contained. It's not a problem. You know, only the people that handled it. Over the last 18 months, I've sent them all this data. You know, my appeal, I'm still getting stuff back from them indicating that they're looking at the automatic denial of the appeal. Not sure. I'm in the process of trying to basically write them a letter that says, hey, eventually the Kirkpatrick Act will go through and, you know, get ready for it. And, you know, ask them, are they, you know, if I were in charge, I would somehow go back through the VA system, find everything with Johnston an island on it and reopen it. But you know, it's hard to say. A lot of it's just bureaucracy, I think. You know, I mean, at the working level where I work with the Wounded Warriors and the VA, incredible people. They really care. This sort of experience, I was warned about it, and it was pretty much what I was expecting. You know, an automatic denial. And you know, if you really want to fight it, get a really high-priced lawyer and go in. And,
yeah.
I'm not in it for the disability monies or anything. All I want is all the people that I worked with for the VA to acknowledge that they were exposed. Because I'm alive. Many aren't. So anyway, that's where that's at.
How many individuals do you know personally from your time in service or either secondhand accounts that have one of the 14 diseases, specifically cancer, or that have succumbed to their illnesses already?
That's a good question. Obviously, my immediate boss died of cancer, and my launch control officer died of cancer. I've heard rumors of others, but I do not have, you know, I've not bothered to do the statistics on it. I'm guessing there's a fair number, but, you know, I don't have the statistics. And, yeah, it's just something we're concerned about.
Okay. No, fair enough. You know, everyone I've talked to so far has personally had health issues, and then also known probably 3 to 5 individuals that they served with that also has had similar issues. Would you say that's probably a fair number, 3 to 5?
I would think so. I mean, the Thor Association has not had a get together since the, you know, our sergeant died, because he was behind the association. So, and at the time of the last get together, people were discussing aches and pains, but, you know, I didn't write any of it down or whatever. So it's hard to say. You know, yeah. 3 to 5 is probably good. You know, I've had cancer, I've had kidney stones, I've had other things, but, you know, I'm still alive, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something. I mean, being alive is obviously great. And you are, all things considered, in pretty good health. It sounds like your things are very well managed, and you're one of the lucky ones, because there are people who are worse off than that, and there are people who are no longer with us. And we remember them.
I agree.
And we tell these stories because of those people. These stories aren't for us. These stories are to honor the people who served our country. And the people who served our country deserve the best, and they deserve to get what's due to them. And that is recognition for their illnesses that they received while in the line of service. And your story helps out with that significantly. Every time I talk to somebody like you, I learn something new. And in this case, my key takeaway is that now I have something to do about it other than just tell a story. So HR 1713 is the next step, and that's the action item. So I'm going to awesome. Take that and I'm going to run with it. And I thank you so much for telling me your story and letting me know about that resolution so I can share that with everyone.
I appreciate it, and keep up the good work. Well, you know, hopefully we'll get some more Johnston Island people involved and go from there.
Yeah, no, if you know anybody who might be willing to share their story, I think it helps a lot. I think it helps more than what people realize. There are people who have never heard of Johnston Island, and there are people who are curious about the subject. Not necessarily Johnston Island specifically, because it's unknown, but the broader subject of atomic veterans is a very big subject. And there's been many articles and movies and documentaries written about it. And every time we do a story, you know, it goes out in podcast form, and then it goes out on YouTube, and it's there forever. So it's not something that's fleeting, and it's searchable because it's digital. Consider it like a digital library, right? So anytime you search for a podcast for Atomic Veterans or Agent Orange or Nuclear Fallout, people are going to hear your story, and they're going to hear Ron, and they're going to hear Frank. And the same with YouTube. And people are curious, and more people than what you think are listening to this. And so that's awareness, and awareness is 90% of the battle.
Well, you know, I mean, we would love to be able to sit down with, you know, some of the people in Congress, give them a briefing type stuff, or just send them information. You know, when the Blue Water came about, I sent the Maine senator on that, basically what I've told you as far as Johnston Island being very comparable to it. The beauty of Johnston Island was the when they were looking at the Blue Water Act, the concern was there was no data. All right. Johnston Island, every VA claim was information that they could have used. And they might have, I don't know, it's hard to say. You know, we sent them the Air Force Brooks Lab data. We didn't have the Boston University yet. So anyway, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And so if I you really could please appreciate the opportunity.
No, thank you for coming on. And if you could please share with me those documents we spoke about, I'll do what I can to run those up the flag.
Yeah. You know, and if I ever get that real report, that would kind of cornerstone it. But right now, all we've got is one line on a 2-page letter. But it was, if you read what it really said, it basically said there was dioxin in the lagoon and in the water system.
You absolutely, and I'll try to dig up the real report too. You know, that's something I'm good at. So University of Utah, and I know the letter. So once I have that in my hands, I'll kind of know what the reference, and then I can start doing some digging.
The University of Utah, it was the Flammability Research Center. All right, this was back in the 70s. It does not exist anymore. It's probably in the chemistry department, but the person that wrote it, as near as I can tell, is passed away. And a lot of this stuff is really hard to find. You've really got to get to it, but you know, you've got better access than I do, so.
Okay.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, and I'll do what I can. So.
All right.
Thank you very much, John.
You take care.
All right, nice speaking with you. Goodbye.
Right.